The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, my name is Naomi Lambert from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share articles with you from The Assembly, which publishes in-depth reporting on North Carolina at theassemblync.com. Today we're starting with an article from Higher Education written by Corey Dean. UNC Chapel Hill's Chancellor thinks there's an AI bubble. Why it's still a top priority. UNC Chapel Hill Chancellor Lee Roberts and Vice Provosts, overseeing libraries and artificial intelligence, spoke at the Assembly's second Newsmakers event about how the technology will change the university. University of North Carolina Chapel Hill Chancellor Lee Roberts believes the AI bubble will burst, but that doesn't mean that the technology isn't here to stay, Roberts told the crowd at the Assembly's Newsmakers event on Monday. Roberts, who lists artificial intelligence as one of his key priorities at the state's flagship university, said he thinks there's a tendency to overestimate the short-term impacts of new technology. On the other hand, the long-term impacts of technological advances are often underestimated, Roberts said. The conundrum is illustrated through the massive multi-billion dollar investments companies like Meta and Google have funneled towards AI in the last few years since the technology went mainstream. Meanwhile, the gap between spending on AI and the revenue it generates is widening, per the Wall Street Journal. UNC Chapel Hill, which has an annual budget of about $4.5 billion, can't compete with that level of spending on AI, Roberts acknowledged. Nor can it compete with the computing power of major tech companies, something universities have historically prided themselves on, he said, which will require a mindset shift. But he predicted AI will reshape just about everything we do at the university and when students leave to start their careers. He spoke from experience, recounting his time as a summer law associate, which coincided with the advent of online legal research services like LexisNexis. As the youngest people in the office, Roberts said, he and his fellow associates were often called upon to teach their older colleagues about the technology and were expected to work faster because they knew how to use it. I think that's very close to what's happening now, Roberts said. We need to organize ourselves to take advantage of this very rapid change while recognizing that things are evolving quickly, he said, adding that the challenge for those of us in leadership positions is to make sure we're harnessing that appropriately in a directed way. Some of that vision is already taking shape. As part of a newly announced merger of the university's School of Information and Library Science and School of Data Science and Society, former SILS Dean Jeffrey Bardzell is now serving as the university's first Vice Provost for Artificial Intelligence and Chief AI Officer. Bardzell said that higher education's hallmark pursuit of knowledge, which can often move slowly and take years for incremental scientific discoveries to unfold, could be at odds with the quick pace at which AI technologies are being developed and beginning to change society. But, he said, the disconnect could also give higher education an advantage. I think a role of higher education is to do a better job of distinguishing between the shiny objects that are dominating the headlines and the deep things underneath that really are changing and really are enduring, Bardzell said at Monday's event, which came at the conclusion of his first day on the job. As chief AI officer, much of Bardzell's work will focus on coordinating the use of AI and the standards for doing so across classrooms, labs, and the university's business operations. But teaching and learning is initially the highest priority, he said. I do think there is an urgent need to make sure that we are doing our job to prepare the future workforce, Bardzell said. The university libraries, led by Vice Provost Maria Estorino, have been working for nearly 2 years to understand how students, professors, and staff are using AI and how the libraries can continue to democratize access to knowledge and the tools used to create it in the context of the new technology. As an overarching principle, Esther Reno said, UNC Chapel Hill's library staff now view AI as a cultural technology, much like the advent of personal computers. The library's work so far has largely involved building literacy skills for AI. Esther Reno said, for instance, faculty might invite librarians to teach their class about AI, or librarians might host workshops like the recent AI for Skeptics. We don't serve any one department, we serve them all, and our engagement with technology, historically, really makes us this important nexus in this work, Esther Reno said, because we are going to work to meet people where they are and to diminish the barriers to access to those technologies. The libraries are also confronting how AI impacts their own work. At one point, the university catalogue was down for a couple of weeks after it was attacked by bots looking to scrape our catalogues for content to train machines, Esther Reno said. She and her staff have also seen AI create false citations of our collection. We've had several instances of researchers coming to us with a citation that just does not exist in our collections, that AI generated, she said. Regarding students' use of AI, Esther Reno said she thinks the group wants more guidance on acceptable use and how they will be evaluated if they choose to use the technology for assignments. We hear from students that they are choosing not to use AI just in case that's going to count as some sort of cheating or violation of the student code, she said. There's a little bit of lack of clarity for them when it's not spelled out explicitly in their syllabi or by their professor. Faculty need clarity too. Bardzell, responding to a question about how the university might equip professors to detect fabricated data or other work, said it can be difficult to detect whether something was written by AI. He suggested the answer might lie in raising standards for student work or moving to a more portfolio-based evaluation rather than the traditional testing. I think that the deceptive use of AI is something that's totally unacceptable, and I think we need to communicate that, Bardzell said. I also think we need to communicate the processes by which we produce knowledge. Even amid the increased focus on AI, Roberts said it shouldn't be construed as the university's guiding principle, as a national outlet recently described the Chancellor's push on the technology. I describe our North Star as our mission and service to the people of North Carolina, Roberts said. The university is looking to enroll more students and expand its offerings in engineer amid a shortage of engineers in the state and nationally, topics Roberts also addressed Monday. The university hasn't articulated a plan for how it will establish an engineering school. The state legislature considered a bill to require UNC Chapel Hill to start its own program, though it didn't become law, and the university looked into buying an existing school in Michigan but dropped the idea. Roberts said any engineering school at UNC Chapel Hill won't seek to compete with other strong engineering schools at NC State and other in-state universities. Instead, UNC Chapel Hill will focus on expanding existing programs in biomedical and environmental engineering, data science, and applied physical sciences, and add to them over time. To accommodate the expanded programs and the additional 5,000 students the university wants to enroll over the next decade, Roberts said leaders will look to Carolina North, the largely undeveloped tract of land that the university has long wanted to make into a mixed-use space to house it. Projects at the site could include classroom and lab space, housing, and athletic facilities per the university. I believe we have an obligation as the state grows, as part of our mission to serve the state, to try and grow as effectively as we can, Roberts said. And next we're going to turn to elections. This article is by Krista Dutton and it's entitled "To Protest Gerrymandering, This NC Democrat Is Running as a Republican." Kate Barr previously ran an unwinnable race to make a point about gerrymandering. Now she's entering the GOP primary against U.S. Representative Tim Moore. Kate Barr is a Democrat from North Carolina, and she sees just one viable way to be elected to Congress, running as a Republican. Barr is challenging Republican Representative Tim Moore for his seat in the suburbs of Charlotte, a district that the Cook Political Report considers solid Republican. Her bid is serious, she says, and she wants candidates in other gerrymandered states to adopt her strategy too. That's part of why we're trying it, she said. The national redistricting battle is making more districts in the country effectively non-competitive. North Carolina's current congressional map is drawn to favor Republicans in 10 of its 14 districts. The state passed a new map last month for 2026 that advantages Republicans along the state's coast, a district currently represented by a Democrat, Representative Don Davis. States like Indiana, Texas, Ohio, and Missouri are heeding President Donald Trump's call to secure the House majority through new congressional maps. Democrats are jumping into the fray too. Last week, California voters approved doing their own redistricting to counter Republicans. Barr's campaign is both a long shot and a sign of the times. There's been a growth in unorthodox campaigns in recent cycles. More independents are running and gaining momentum across the country. Political strategists attribute this to dissatisfaction with both parties. Barr is part of this trend, they say. This is a moment where we need a wider range of candidates that are taking creative and unorthodox approaches, whether that is independents running and shedding partisan labels like you saw with Dan Osborne in Nebraska, and like I think we'll see with an increasing number of candidates, or people with heterodox views like Kate Barr, deciding to change their partisan affiliation and running in primaries instead of general elections, said Asher Hildebrand, a former Democratic operative and a professor of public policy at Duke University. Barr ran for a seat in the State House in 2024 with the slogan, Kate Barr can't win. She embraced her inevitable failure to call attention to the state's gerrymandered map. She lost, badly. This time, she's actually trying to win. Part of the reason we're calling this campaign Kate Barr Can Win is because it is actually as ridiculous that I can win in a Republican primary as when I couldn't win in a general election, Barr said. She's also established a 501c4 nonprofit, the Can't Win Victory Fund, which she said is helping candidates in other states run a Can't Win campaign like she did last year. Barr said 250 people have told the nonprofit they'd also like to run to lose. They are planning on creating a super PAC at the beginning of 2026. The fund's website says the can't diduts joining her protest campaign movement would receive a sizable donation from her fund and training from experienced political consultants and political losers. As for her race, Barr's campaign estimates that she needs 33,000 votes to win. North Carolina has closed primaries, meaning for Democrats to vote for her, they'd have to switch their party affiliation. But Barr says she has a shot at turning out the roughly 38% of voters in the district who are registered as unaffiliated and can vote in either party's primary. Barr also said that she'd rather be on the ballot in March than November because she expects voter suppression to worsen during the midterms. We have to win where we can, while we can, as soon as we can, she said. Barr declined to share with Notice how much money her campaign has raised ahead of the first reporting deadline. North Carolina Republicans shrugged off Barr's approach. A spokesperson for Moore's campaign called Barr's run a stunt that is an insult to Republican voters. Folks know a far-left fraud when they see one. Matt Mercer, communications director of the NCGOP, also called the campaign insulting. Riley Richardson, a spokesperson for the National Republican Congressional Committee, said Kate Barr is an out-of-touch Democrat whose congressional campaign is nothing more than a personal vanity project. Barr's radical policies have no place in North Carolina, and she has no chance of beating Congressman Moore. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee did not respond to Notice's request for comment. Republicans in the state are willing to celebrate some Democrats switching parties. Democrats, realised the socialist leadership infecting the party no longer represents them, Mercer said. Three county commissioners in Robeson County and the long-time Democratic sheriff in New Hanover County switched to the Republican Party this year. And the most infamous convert is State Representative Tricia Cotham, whose flip in 2023 gave Republicans a supermajority in the State House. Barr's switch, however, isn't because her politics have changed. She's still a Democrat, but if elected to Congress, she said she plans to advocate for policies that have bipartisan support, like fair congressional maps, a $20 minimum wage, and no federal income tax on the first $100,000 that anyone earns. While incumbents have advantages like greater fundraising and political legacy, Hildebrand said there is always the chance that an anti-incumbent mood strikes the electorate. Just to dismiss Barr's campaign as a gimmick or a stunt would probably overlook a lot of those trends that could create an opening for somebody like her, he said. The North Carolina Republican primary is scheduled for March 3, 2026. Brent Caldwell, a Charlotte attorney, is running as the Democratic nominee. Our next article is by Jeffrey Billman, and it's entitled Up in Smoke. On Saturday night, eight Democratic-aligned U.S. senators joined Republicans to fund the federal government through January without extending health care subsidies. The Democrats' key demand throughout the longest shutdown in history. By Wednesday, President Donald Trump had signed the bill. The government got up and running again. Somewhat lost amid the ensuing liberal recriminations and Trump world gloating was a last-minute addition to the 394-page bill Congress passed, pushed by Republican Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, that could devastate a fast-growing sector of North Carolina's economy. A six-page provision sandwiched between a rollback of food regulations and a $2 million grant to catfish processors criminalizes many hemp-derived products and all intoxicating hemp products. That could mean the end of the edibles, vapes, and drinks that have proliferated throughout North Carolina's convenience stores, dispensaries, and bars in recent years. McConnell has argued that in Kentucky, cannabis-related calls to the Poison Control Center have doubled in the last 5 years. He blamed malicious actors who marketed intoxicating products to kids. North Carolina has seen a similar phenomenon. Business NC reported last month that cannabis-related calls to poison control doubled between 2000 and 2024. But critics say McConnell's fix employed a chainsaw instead of a scalpel. The restrictions are so sweeping that they'll make many non-intoxicating CBD products illegal, said Phil Dixon Jr., a professor at the University of North Carolina School of Government and an expert on cannabis law. It's going to radically rework the hemp industry at a bare minimum, Dixon said. I'm not sure it will completely snuff it out of existence, but my expectation would be that, yes, you would see stores close and people let go, and the market would take an enormous hit. Rod Kite, an Asheville-based cannabis industry attorney, had a more dire outlook. I think it's important that people know that this will kill the hemp industry completely, he said. Marijuana is illegal under federal law, though more than half of Americans live in states where it can be legally purchased. North Carolina is not one of them. In 2018, however, the federal farm bill legalized hemp, which comes from the same plant species as marijuana, but has only trace elements of the psychoactive Delta-9 THC. Depending on your perspective, Congress's definition created either a loophole or an opportunity. Companies found that they could easily turn legal hemp into intoxicating products. That quickly gave rise to a nearly $30 billion industry that supports the jobs of more than 300,000 people nationally, according to a 2023 report from a hemp industry-aligned economist. For comparison, that is about the same size as the craft beer industry. The 2023 report estimated that annual sales of hemp-derived products in North Carolina were between $759 million and $1.1 billion. The industry supported nearly 9,000 jobs here at the time, the report said. Other estimates differ. Industry sources put sales closer to $2.5 billion, owing in part to the surging popularity of cannabis-infused beverages. On the other hand, in 2024, as the General Assembly considered regulating hemp products, its Fiscal Research Division predicted about $1.1 billion in hemp-related sales over 5 years, or an average of about $220 million per year. Regardless, the industry's foothold is undeniably significant in North Carolina, and it's growing quickly. I think it's not widely known outside the industry, but North Carolina is considered to be one of the, if not the, very top state for hemp, Kite said. Several of the largest and most well-known cannabis brands in the world have specifically located their hemp divisions in North Carolina. North Carolina hasn't legalized medical or recreational marijuana, so there's less competition. No less important, the state's hemp marketplace is almost entirely unregulated. There are no age restrictions, dosage limits, licensing agreements, or required tests for hemp-derived products. If you're a business that's looking for a friendly place to relocate, one that doesn't have any regulations looks pretty damn friendly, Kite said. He and many other insiders think it's too friendly. State Representative John Bell, a Goldsboro Republican and until recently the president of hemp company Astera Labs, has frequently called the market the Wild Wild West. Bell, who became Astera's president in 2023, said he left several weeks ago after improving Astera's operations and hiring his replacement. He still works for Astera's parent company, Rise Capital. Most state lawmakers agree that the hemp industry needs guardrails, but they haven't agreed on what they should look like. In 2023, Bell, then the House Majority Leader, backed a bill that would have required hemp buyers to be at least 18 years old and required all hemp products to be tested, among other things. The House unanimously passed it, but it died after the Senate added a provision allowing medical marijuana. This year, Bell supported similar hemp legislation. Instead, the state Senate passed a regulatory bill that Bell said would have destroyed the industry. It has languished in the House's Rules Committee, which Bell chairs. Now, the existential threat comes from Congress. I've been a voice for regulation for years, Bell told the Assembly. I'm disappointed that the federal government had a chance to put solid regulations in place and instead they chose to kill an industry which now puts everything back in the black market and does not prevent the harmful products from being sold to kids. Hemp products won't come off the store shelves immediately. The provision doesn't take effect for a year, and the industry will almost certainly mount an aggressive lobbying campaign to convince Congress to change its mind. Even if that doesn't work, the General Assembly will still get to weigh in. The federal legislation doesn't change state law, and North Carolina's law is a bare-bones statute that says hemp is legal, and that's that, Kite said. In that sense, it's like marijuana law, illegal at the federal level, but legal to some degree in 45 states. North Carolina's law will stay that way unless the legislature acts. I presume many states will amend their laws to fit with the new federal definition and use this as an opportunity to shut down the intoxicating hemp market, Dixon said. But to the extent a state didn't want to do that, they would be free to say, we're not changing our law. And under state law, these are still legal products. But friendlier state legislation or even a continued General Assembly stalemate might not save North Carolina's hemp businesses, Kite said. The federal ban creates tax and banking problems, as well as difficulties in luring investors. More importantly, it's a national industry. Companies source and sell across state lines, Under the new law, what is today routine interstate commerce could be considered felony drug trafficking. The silver lining is that the hemp industry in the United States has been somewhat fragmented, and I think this really unites the industry and lights a fire to educate our lawmakers as to why you can't pull the rug out from underneath a multi-billion dollar industry, Kite said. For the final article today, I'm going to give a quick summary of The Politics of an Arrest by Michael Hewlett from November 14th. Rockingham County Sheriff Sam Page wanted to keep politics out of a news conference he held a few weeks ago, announcing the arrest of a former sheriff's deputy accused of sexual assault. He bristled when he couldn't. It might have been impossible. Page is, after all, running in a Republican primary to unseat one of the most powerful state legislators, Senate leader Phil Berger, in what has already become a high-profile, claws-bared political slugfest. "You're being political," Page said, responding to a reporter's question about negative campaign ads against him. "I'm being professional, ma'am. I'm the sheriff of Rockingham County. I'm a 43-year veteran of law enforcement, and I'm here today to tell you what's happened and what we're doing to protect our citizens and our inmates." The previous day, Page had fired Christopher Lee Garrison, 32, after Garrison was accused of sexually assaulting a 21-year-old female inmate at a local hospital. Another sheriff's deputy had reported the incident to Page and other sheriff's officials at 7:30 a.m. Tuesday. Page said he immediately suspended Garrison and called in the State Bureau of Investigation to look into the alleged assault. By the end of business Tuesday, Garrison, who had been with the sheriff's office since August 2021, had lost his job and been charged with felony sexual activity by a parent or custodian. He is in the Rockingham County Jail on a $200,000 bond. Garrison's attorney, Jason E. Ross, declined to comment. Garrison's arrest this week and the press conference underscored how Page's leadership of his agency, particularly the jail, has become a key issue for his political campaign. A newly formed political action group called NC True Conservatives has been running a series of cartoonish ads attacking Page, calling him Shady Sam. One of those ads focuses on numerous scandals that have plagued Page's administration. Berger has also gone after Page for his operation of the jail. And there is plenty of fodder. State officials say 13 inmates have died since 2021. That's all we have time for, I'm afraid. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Assembly. We hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to tune in next time. I'm Naomi Lambert for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is now available as a podcast on our website, the ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.